Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:38 p.m. on Thursday, March 30th, 2017. Present today we have Representative Ortiz, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Gren, and Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Representative Guttenberg is excused from today's meeting. And before we start, just a reminder, folks could... Representative Vice Chair Guerra is also with us here in the back. If folks could mute their cell phones. And at this time, we'll be addressing the fiscal notes on HB 115, income tax, permanent fund credit, permanent fund income. And we will have an introductory hearing on HB 137, which is the State Council on the Arts as a public corporation. So with that, first I'd like to bring up Ken Alper. Ken, are you? There he is. Director of the Tax Division, and Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director of the Tax Division, to the table. And gentlemen, please put yourselves on the record. And since we have two male voices, these proceedings are transcribed. Prior to speaking, if you could state your name. And for ease of following the discussion online and in members' packets is a document titled HB 115, Fiscal Notes, and the first five notes are from the Department of Revenue. And with that, gentlemen, if you could go ahead and walk the department through the fiscal notes. With that, we've got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was brought to my attention yesterday that there is a Rick Pomp, I don't know if I got the last name wrong, that has been hired by the administration for research and advice on proposed tax legislation. And since we had a lot of questions, especially on the trust issues, is there any way that we'll have an opportunity to hear from him on maybe some of the questions that we haven't been able to get answered? Because he has a contract right now for $85,000 for this particular bill, so if he, I would hope that he might be able to answer some of the questions that we have given, because we heard from Revenue on, especially on the trust ones, that they weren't experts in trusts, and we also heard in public testimony some big major concerns. Is this possibly somebody that we can hear from that will be able to answer our questions, especially before we have our amendments that are due tomorrow?
Let's take a really quick brief at ease so I can talk with my staff here and see if we can figure something out. So brief at ease.
Nice. Thank you.
Okay, House Finance is back on record, and what we're going to do is Mr. Ken Alper, I think, can address this question, and before we adjourn today, we'll take a brief at ease to decide if this gentleman is available. But Mr. Alper, if you could, I guess, kind of talk a little bit to that.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Alper. For the record, I am the director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And I just want to give a little bit of backstory as to who Rick Pomp is, Professor Pomp, and why he's part of this process. He is a an attorney, a professor at the University of Connecticut, who was on contract with the administration. Now, to back up a few months, you may recall, Mr. Chairman, there was an income tax bill that the governor introduced in the last session. It had some hearings. It was structurally very similar to Chairman Seaton's bill from that time. What we learned during that process was that our income tax language was structurally a little bit obsolete, that we needed to update the nature of it. So the way it works inside the administration is we put in requests for new bills for the approval of the governor's office some months in advance, long before it's known whether the bill is actually going to be introduced. So when I put in the request to get the income tax bill ready for the 2017 session, I made what I thought was a simple request to say, let's update the language to make it so that we're taxing adjusted gross income rather than share of federal liability. And the issues that came up on federal liability were, first off, it's no other state is currently taxing that. Of the 41 states that now have an income tax, 29 are based on adjusted gross income. It's much harder to apportion income between resident and non-resident. What is the attributable share from Alaska? That sort of thing. So just for reasons of technical modernization, we wanted a different structure to the income tax. And what I heard back from the Department of Law was, we do not have in-house expertise to do that. Would you please find someone who could help us write that language? So we found a little bit of money, we had a request for proposals, and the award went to this Professor Pomp in Connecticut. He was hired by the executive branch. His deliverable for his contract, which has now been made public, was for $85,000, was the draft of an income tax bill. That was written as if it would be introduced by the administration. Thus far, no decision had been made whether the governor wanted to introduce his own income tax bill. When the Finance Committee put out their own income tax bill, we let them know we had this language available. Did you want to change the structure of the bill? What's key here is that it's the structure, the definitions of income from a source within the state. What does domicile mean? How do you take S-corporation income of a non-resident and apportion the share to Alaska? All of those many pages of technical language, that's what we got from Professor Pomp. The tax tables and the personal exemption and the amount of revenue side, that does not come from the administration. That is what came from the co-chairs and as far as the structure of the committee substitute before you. So that's sort of the background on the technical language. As far as Professor Pomp's availability, his contract is complete. He has provided us the draft. He has said to us he's prepared to testify, although I don't think we can get him to Juneau. He would be prepared to call in. We just would have to arrange that time. I don't think that he is in particular a trust expert. He is an expert on state and local taxation. In fact, any members who've been to law school might have read his textbook called State and Local Taxation, which is in its 8th edition, not to give the professor a plug. But this is the question of how trusts are taxed is technical and complex. Neither Deputy Director Spanos nor I possess that specific expertise. I think it would be beneficial to the committee to have someone speaking on the record as to how the bill is structured in that specific instance. I don't know if Professor Pomp is the right person for that, but I just wanted to get it out there who he is, why he's there, and what his role was in the creation of this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, so a couple questions I have. First, where did the money come from to be able to pay for this individual?
Through the Chair, Representative Pruitt, the money came from the Tax Division's general fund budget. We were able to find a little bit simply because because of the hiring freeze and a relatively high vacancy rate, we had unspent money in our current year budget that we were able to repurpose to that contract.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So you mentioned that you put out requests for proposals. Did you go through the normal procurement process, and why was it determined that this individual would meet the needs?
So through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the money was sent through what's known as a reimbursable services agreement or an interagency transfer to the Department of Law. The Department of Law, who has the legal procurement expertise, headed up the contract. It was a traditional competitive request for proposal. I don't believe it was a low bidder type thing. It was this one is the one that seems to meet our needs the best, but I do not know precisely what the review criteria and decision matrix was.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Was it the intent that if a bill was not offered by the by one of the co-chairs or by one of the individuals in the legislature, that the governor would be introducing a bill that came out of the product from this professor?
Well, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there was no decision one way or the other. So far as I know, my job in the fall in particular is to be prepared. We didn't know if the governor was going to want an income tax bill. We knew he had one in the previous year. And if he was going to want one, we wanted to have a good one, one that would be, frankly, administrable, enforceable. It's not about do you want an income tax or not at that point. If we are going to pass an income tax, we want to make sure that it's a bill where the technical details make sense and could be implemented. So we did this in part to be prepared. I have no idea if any decision was made or will be made as to whether the governor wants an income tax bill this year in his own name.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So $85,000 for a we might do something or might not. I mean, that's a lot of money. Are there other instances that you are aware of, whether it's in your department, the Department of Revenue itself, where we are spending money on things that you may or may not take action on, and how much would that equate to?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I don't have any specific examples from my two-plus year tenure as tax director. This is the one substantial outside contract that we funded. The conversation was had that this is useful knowledge. We need to have better income tax language. Most likely someone will need it. It seems to be a reasonable investment. And so, no, we're not of the habit of spending money on things we're not going to need, obviously. But this is one we had a strong sense that someone was going to need in one way or another. The income tax language, again, that was debated last session was technically incomplete. It needed additional work. It was based on a tax that was repealed in the state in 1979. The national thinking on income taxes has gone a long way in the last 30-plus years, so it was just time to update the language. No decision, obviously, was made back then as to what would actually become of the eventual language.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kara and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Folks on this committee have their different opinions, but I just don't want anybody to think anything was being hidden from anybody. I haven't met this gentleman. What's his name again, Mr. Alper?
Through the chair, Professor Richard Pomp, P-O-M-P.
I haven't spoken to him, but I did speak to Mr. Alper this year before session, and I was curious whether the governor was going to introduce an income tax, and we spoke, and Mr. Alper was completely forthright that they had or were planning on hiring somebody like this. Mr. Alper, if you had the same conversation with any other member of this committee, would you have provided that information too?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I spoke to many people in the interim and in the weeks and months of the session before the language came out. It was in no way not out there for all who wish to know that there was an outside contractor helping us with income tax language.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just didn't want anybody to think that if they too had spoken to Mr. Alper, that he wouldn't have also said to them that they had been working with this person. And Mr. Alper, just so it's clear to folks, I was one of the people who thought if we were going to have an income tax, we should have our own rates, because charging a percentage of the federal tax would not let you exempt the permanent fund dividend from taxation. So, Mr. Alper, if we charged a percent of federal income tax instead of having our own rates, you would not be able to have a deduction line for the permanent fund dividend. That's my understanding. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the bill could be written however the legislature wills. You could theoretically write it at a percentage of federal liability minus the dividend or something like that. The formula could be written in different ways, but you do raise an important issue of tying the tax to federal liability, and that is the federal tax could change outright. We have a new administration in Washington. They're talking about changes to the federal tax code, and if everyone's federal income tax were cut in half, then Alaska's revenues from the income tax would simultaneously be cut in half. By having a tax rate tied to gross income, it does create a lot more let's call it dependability or predictability as far as what Alaska's revenues would be.
Federal, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And, you know, without speaking to this gentleman who I still haven't spoken to, I just, you know, after hearing some of the commentary in this committee, I'd like to say that I looked at the percentage of federal liability thing, and I thought, well, then your income tax is going to go up or go down depending on who's in Washington, D.C., and I thought we should just have a stable tax rate if we were going to adopt an income tax. And somehow many of us sort of magically came up with that idea on our own. I don't think we needed an outside consultant to tell us that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the consultant doesn't need it to come up with the idea, but it is a very technically complex piece of legislation that's before you, the committee substitute to 115. My intent was to have our own Department of Law attorneys draft this. That's what we asked for, just like any other pre-session bill drafting request from the administration. They came back to us and said, we do not have anyone on the current staff of the Department of Law who has that specific technical language. And we were requested to go and find outside counsel. So we did so. I know that the state of Alaska hires outside counsel with specific expertise for lots of different reasons, most prominently for litigation services, but also for various consulting reasons.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's amazing when you ask about an expert how many things are read into this. I asked about this person because if he has answers to questions that we have put on the record that we have yet to receive the correct answer on how this complicated tax is going to work for individuals, I'm supposed to find out those answers. So if there's an expert there that the administration or law or revenue used, then I thought that was a perfect opportunity to be able to get the answers. That's all that was written into this. Could you just tell me when the contract was ended?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't know if there's a defined end date to the contract. The deliverable was the draft bill. So I don't know to what extent Professor Pomp has been paid on the contract. I presume that he has been, but he has delivered the primary deliverable in the contract, so he would deserve to be paid.
Follow-up? Of course he deserves to be paid. I'm not saying he shouldn't have been paid. I'm just asking, when was the deliverable delivered?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we received an early draft of this bill in the month of December. He came to Juneau and met with Department of Revenue and Department of Law and Governor's Office staff for a couple of days. We worked through that. We marked it up a little, cleaned it up, and he came back with a final draft of it to us, I believe, in January. The Department of Law then took that draft and added their own sort of conventions of Alaska legal drafting principles to it, and turned that into a draft to us that we got, in the later part of January.
Perfect. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
So this contract was signed December 12th, and he was done approximately somewhere in January, as you stated, and we paid him $85,000. So I just want to make sure that was on record. But my other question is, you said that part of the deliverable with this gentleman was that he found it hard to do a difference, and I'm assuming, between residents and non-residents. So I'm thinking as far as deductions you would give to residents versus non-residents. But we heard at the beginning of this that couldn't even be done, that you had to give the same exemptions to residents as non-residents, which I know not to be true because I've done other taxes before. So do you have any information on what was like a draft that would have possibly shown how we could have treated the residential tax different than a non-resident? Because that's what we've heard in public comment, that if we're going to do something like this, that non-residents shouldn't get the same exemptions. And I know the dividends is washed, so you can't even really use it. So do you have any kind of background on that we would be able to see on maybe ideas that he may have brought forward as far as having a difference between a resident and non-resident?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, let me try to rephrase what I said earlier. The technically complex part of a bill like this, or any income tax bill, is properly apportioning income between that which is from an origin in the state and that which is not. That is what the professor helped us to come up with tightly defined language that could do that. There are a couple of specific ways in which our tax code in this, the language in this bill would favor a resident over a non-resident. You know, one would be that the personal exemption, the $4,000 thing, is essentially prorated for the non-resident. They would only get the portion of that that is the Alaska share of their overall income. So if they earned half their income from Alaska and half not from Alaska, they would only get the equivalent of about a $2,000 personal exemption. Another important example, let's use the example of someone who might have a business in the lower 48, makes $200,000 a year, and let's say they have a seasonal business in Alaska where they earn another $50,000. This is a non-resident with a $250,000 income. The way this bill is constructed, that person would pay income tax not at the $50,000 bracket, but at the $250,000 bracket, which is higher, but they'd pay 20% of those taxes to the state of Alaska because only 20% of their income comes to Alaska. So that gives us the ability to take a slightly higher share pro rata-wise from the non-resident. That is a way, it's a small benefit, but it's a way we can skew this bill to favor the Alaskan over the non-resident.
Interesting. So, Mr. Chairman, my whole point of even asking about this is that I'm very uncomfortable that we have been asked to do amendments and have them done by tomorrow. There was questions raised in public testimony, as well as questions by committee members here that we still haven't been able to get to answered. And all I've been told is, well, write an amendment. Well, I can't just write an amendment because I don't have the expertise. I'm not I'm not exactly sure. More than a CPA that you would have to be able to understand what this all does. And that was the reason I raised the question. I honestly thought this would have been someone that could have answered those questions and had an integral part of writing a bill. And I didn't know whether this was a bill or a different one was, but there are just a lot of questions still out there, and I just want to make sure that we can go home and tell our constituents this is why we did this or why we didn't do this, and not find out that in a year when this is written, all of a sudden it's had some consequences none of us ever thought could happen until people start filing their taxes the first time. So that was the reason I brought the name up. I thought it could be a big help to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Prior to adjourning today, we'll take a brief at ease and figure this out, our path forward. Representative Pruitt, did you have a question?
I more of a statement. Some of my frustration comes from in this whole discussion is I think a while back, there had been some requests to have some people come and help answer some of these questions. And I guess, why did we have to ask right here about the person who wrote this? That we had to, as far as we understood that this had come from the co-chair of finance had offered this until he had indicated that it came from the governor. Then from there, okay, who had written this? So we've had three different meetings with different people, and we've asked some of the same questions, and at no point in time has anyone indicated the person that wrote all of this stuff was someone else, that there was this other person out there. No one even offered up that this person was out there and could maybe even answer the questions. And it's not just for my edification. There's a lot of people watching this that are really concerned about this that I'm getting questions from, and I'm trying to make sure that I understand the concepts here, and they're trying to figure this out. And these are people that are experts in this thing, and we had to ask in committee today, based on stuff that we learned, that there was a guy that from outside of the state that wrote this stuff. I don't understand it. You want to understand why I'm frustrated? It feels like there was a secret being kept. And I don't know if that's the attempt. I don't think that's the attempt. I know my co-chairs, and I don't think they were in any way trying to keep that. But this is frustrating. And I think I'm not the only one. The public's out there, and I think they were a little frustrated that somehow this had to come up somewhere else, and I was hearing it from someone else that this was written by someone outside of the state. And we've been asking questions I think he could have answered a while back. And it's just frustrating. That's all I want to leave, Mr. Chair, is just my frustration on the table here. I don't know if I have some of the same questions because I've spent some time on it, but I think we may have wasted some time in this because this guy apparently wrote all of this stuff and he wasn't available.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for information, of course, we had public testimony the other day, and we had the trust attorneys from the state, around the state, call in and raise some questions, and we've been in contact with them since that to try to figure out exactly what they saw as problematic language and that kind of thing, and we are working with them on getting language to make sure that everything is written in the way that we're interpreting it. And so, you know, there'll be amendments coming out on that, and we'll go forward from there. The process is the process, and we've had committee meetings on a number of things. We had issues raised, and we're getting answers as best we can to those issues. So I presume that you and Representative Wilson are also talking to trust attorneys that are telling you what language they would like to see in the bill to come forward with amendments. But as far as us here in committee sitting around the table writing the exact language, I mean, I presume that you are doing the same as we are and going to experts in Alaska that have concern with the language, and that's the process. And I imagine that we will be seeing some amendments slightly different, but that will come forward and be discussed before the committee after the amendments come forward to solve those questions that you ask in committee and I ask in committee. And we had one of the trust attorneys or trust administrators here and testifying for that reason. So anyway, that's the process that's going forward. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, one of the, I appreciate that. But at the same time, we just heard from the tax director that there's no one in the state that has this expertise. And so discovering it through the public, I appreciate the public testimony aspect of it. If I write a bill and I'm the sponsor sitting right there, it's written by someone in that building right across there, and we can get them to call in and tell us why they decided to make certain decisions and technical decisions. The person that wrote aspects of this bill was not available to us, like the person right across there would be available to us. And that's that for the frustration. We shouldn't have had the trust people had to call in and say, here's some help. We should have actually, the questions that were asked by Representative Wilson shouldn't have had to come through a public testimony discussion, but through the person who wrote the bill, who wasn't available to us, as any other bill that any of us were to offer in here would have been available to us from the person that was right across from there. That's the frustration, is we shouldn't have had public testimony, should have been answered when she asked the question in committee the very first time by the person who wrote the language, and that was not available to us.
Representative Garrett.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move on to like something substantive, but I know they're not meant as accusations, but I would like to just clarify the record on a few things. And of course, from my understanding, though I haven't been there, any suggestion that this person wrote this bill, I think, is patently untrue. So I hope nobody meant to make that suggestion. This whole idea that legislators are helpless to figure out how to write a bill, I think that's sad. I think legislators are allowed to do research. I know I've been calling people to try and figure out what to do on this trust issue for days. And I think it would be really surprising to me that somebody else wouldn't know how to do that. But the accusations that have been suggested, even though they've been maybe unintentional, have bothered me. I don't think anybody wrote this bill for anybody else, and I think it's a sad thing to hear that kind of rhetoric.
With that,
Mr. Chair, I want to make it very clear there were no accusations.
Representative Pruitt, go ahead. What's that?
Frustrations, not accusations. I want to make it very clear.
Any further questions of the committee? Hearing none. Okay, hearing none, let's move to Mr. Spanos and Mr. Upper fiscal notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we're happy to continue talking either on or off the record about the pedigree of the language with any individual member later on. But let's get to the fiscal notes because the clock is ticking. What we have before you, and I hadn't seen it in this format, on the table outside the room is a package of fiscal notes. Looks like this. That gives me some direction and sequence. I'll go through it in the order that the notes are in this packet. The decision was made for this version of the bill to break the Department of Revenue's fiscal note into multiple pieces. What was initially proposed was a single fiscal note that did a lot of different things, and for ease of understanding, there are at least four different Department of Revenue fiscal notes plus a couple from other agencies. The first one in the packet is limited to the income tax itself. It's a four-page note, in large part because of the narrative and a couple of tables describing the some of the details in the bill, the staffing requirements, the interface of the revenues with the permanent fund changes, and the like. The key issue here is this is a bill that's going to raise something approaching $700 million a year. The numbers change a little bit every year based on expected changes in the workforce and the total state income and who's going to fall into what bracket. But to the extent we can model this with our own income tax model, the first full year of this bill would be fiscal year 2020. Now, that's important for members to understand. The bill as written, the income tax sections do not have an effective date until January 1st, 2019. That's over a year and a half from now. What that means is the first withholding, the first paycheck where there will be an impact of an income tax will be after January of 2019. So fiscal year 2019, which is the first 6 months of calendar year 2019, we expect to see withholding tax, taxes coming in from employers withheld from paychecks. Also, we anticipate there'll be a certain amount of estimated tax payments on some of the higher income taxpayers. That's why if you look at the fiscal note, the $341 million number in FY19, that represents, roughly speaking, half a year's worth of revenue, the amount that would come in the second half of the fiscal year, the first half of calendar year 2019. The first actual tax filings, the returns coming into the department, wouldn't happen until the 2020, probably April 15th, 2020, the federal tax filing deadline would be when the bulk of ours would come in. And then going to FY21 and beyond, you're seeing similar numbers. So there's a lot of other numbers on this table. Let's start with the capital cost. We're asking for $14 million up front. That seems like a tremendous amount of money, and it is a tremendous amount of money. Granted, this is a bill that's going to bring in $700 million a year, so you're talking 2% of 1 year's revenue. What do you get for $14 million? Well, there are four short-term, very large projects that the tax division will have to embark upon as soon as a bill like this were to pass. The first one is a very aggressive regulations writing project. As complex as Professor Pomp's language, and Ledge Legal also had a strong role in this language, we're going to need to clean up a lot of other details. There's a lot of I's to dot. There's a lot of gray areas, a lot of specifics of how different forms are filled out. This is going to be a very lengthy and extensive regulations project. And frankly, Mr. Chair, I expect there'll be outside contractors to help with the regulations project at that point. The second one, the largest of all, is the programming. We have to build a database, a computer system, forms development, testing, to be able to collect and administer this tax. We have recently completed a $25 million contract that the legislature appropriated back in 2012 to rebuild the tax management system for the tax division. It's been a great success. We're very pleased with the result. We would anticipate using that same contractor and expanding upon that, but that would be a very large contract. At least $10 million of this $14 million would go to it. Also, outreach. We would need to embark upon talking to the Alaskan people, explaining what this income tax is and how it's going to work, and what their expectations should be and what our expectations will be. And finally, of course, is recruitment. We are going to need to hire a substantial new staff to administer this new tax. And that's where you could see some of these position numbers on the front page of the fiscal note. At full implementation by fiscal year 20, we think it will take about 60 new individuals to run a new major tax. Now, just put this in perspective, Mr. Chair. We currently have 25 tax programs. Some of them are quite small. Some of them are larger. Our corporate income tax currently has in the neighborhood of, let's call it, 18,000 taxpayers, 15,000 taxpayers, most of whom file zero tax returns. These include our S corporations. So that's the largest number of customers of any one group that we have in the tax division. This bill would have create a customer base of 400,000 Alaskan households. So it's an order of magnitude larger than anything we're currently doing. So it's going to take not just the auditors and the tax technicians, who tend to be the first line of contact with people, and the supervisory group and some technical expertise and the appeals groups, because inevitably any large tax is going to have appeals, programmers and accounting technicians and all that sort of thing. And there's a table on the fourth page of this fiscal note that highlights, to the best estimates that we have, who these 60 people are going to be and what their job class is. And from that, you could iterate where they'd fit within the state's pay scale. Again, this is a gradual ramp-up. We wouldn't need that much up front. I put four staff in the FY18 budget. That's really bringing in the leadership team. We need a supervisor. We need a technical expert. We probably need a programmer. We need people to help orchestrate the process of getting the regulations drafted and the initial contract with the programming, the computer programmers built. So we need a leadership team in place once we start getting deliverables and once we start getting closer to collecting actual taxes, we'll be ramping up the staff. If you look at the cost of that staff, it's in the neighborhood of, at full implementation, a little over $6.4 million per year, plus the other secondary costs of the personnel. In other words, a lot of that on these lines, what you call the services lines, are what they call duplicated costs. They're payments to other state agencies. We currently pay the Department of Administration for rent for our space in the state office building. We pay the state's personnel office. We pay the Department of Law for various things, postage. All of those are multipliers. So if you look at the current tax division staff, which has 110 positions in it, and add another 60, you could see where a lot of our current costs are going to be half again as large from what they currently are, just from the day-to-day cost of having additional people on the payroll. So that's the basic structure of the income tax. It's a heavy lift. It is one that we are going to be challenged by, but it's one that we believe are within our professional intellectual capacity to be able to incorporate and add to the state of Alaska. I sense you might have a question, Mr. Chairman, so I'm going to pause right here.
Representative Wilson?
Only if Mr. Halpers, it's done with the explanation of the fiscal note, because I have questions specifically on the fiscal note, but if he's not finished.
So on the initial fiscal note, the four-pager on the income tax, the technical, the narrative pages on 2, 3, and 4 describe the specific provisions of the bill, what the tax brackets are, how the withholding is going to work. It just tries to take the bill language itself, or at least the main functional parts of the bill, and translate it into something approaching a plain English explanation. Hopefully we've succeeded in doing that. There's not a whole lot of new information. If you're already familiar with the bill, the language in the narrative should make sense. And then there are two tables, one that is, again, summarizing the revenue, and the other on the last page summarizes the anticipated staffing needs. And now I could call myself done on the income tax fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So has there been any analysis done on the cost of the businesses that will now be required to fill out this paperwork?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I think I want to defer this to Mr. Spanos because I know he spoke a little bit when he was before you a couple of days ago as far as the way personal income taxes and from state and federal income taxes tend to interface with each other, and it's easy to sort of file the two of them at the same time. As far as the impact on businesses of withholding and creating whatever the state's equivalent of the W-2 is going to be called, and we haven't named these forms yet, they're already doing that at the federal level. I can't imagine it would be a substantial additional burden to do what amounts to the same thing with a state form. But I want to pause and see if Mr. Spanos has anything else to add.
For the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division. Representative Wilson through the chair. As far as filing the tax return itself,
for the businesses, I mean,
for the businesses,
I understand that you're going to send Mr. Chairman, you'll be sending the forms out to individuals just like the federal government, I'm anticipating, but there's going to be programs, that's some type of program that's going to have to be available, whether it's electronically or not, to every business out there, corporations and everything else, that will be a cost to those businesses, not to the state.
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, we anticipate the largest cost to the businesses being the withholding. They need to do programming for our withholding tables. And those are generally, they do the withholding, send in one payment, and then send the data behind it. Excuse me, that shows who the employees were for the withholding. The other forms that are required, that we would require from businesses, would be the same forms that the IRS receives. So we don't anticipate a much larger cost there. For instance, a partnership would be filing K-1s with the IRS. They would file the same forms with us.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Wilson.
I'm talking about so they're going to have to purchase some type of program. Do we have any idea whether or not, I mean, there's probably still mom-and-pop shops out there who don't necessarily do things electronic. I don't know whether that's going to be required underneath this. But they're going to have to buy, I mean, is that programming going to be something that the state will do and then charge back to the businesses they'll have to purchase? Because, I mean, you've got a pretty, you know, you've got $14 million in here for what's going to cost the state to do it. So I'm anticipating there'll have to be some type of cost to the businesses as well.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, a big part of our outreach is going to also have to be to the software developers, the TurboTaxes and QuickBookses of the world. I run a small business, my wife does anyway, and what we use QuickBooks in that business. Every few weeks, it seems, I get an update from QuickBooks. Hey, did you download your latest tax table updates? Most of those are the states. The package comes because something happened in Arkansas or Delaware. Like, that's included with the package. So what we would just need to make sure is that the programmers, the owners of those national software programs, internalize the Alaska tax tables so that the people who already own that will automatically get the update that they'll be able to do the withholding of the Alaska income tax from their employees. It will go to the appropriate account, and then they could send their monthly or quarterly checks to the state of Alaska. I don't envision there will be any additional programming or software needs. It just will require an update to the software companies already use.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Somehow I think there'll be a cost, but obviously I'm not going to get a number right now, and we'll see what that'll be. So when we're talking about how much income that's going to come off the income tax, and we asked this question earlier, especially when we had how many percentage of people were in each one of the divisions, but now we have S-Corps, we have trusts, we have estates, then we have the individual income tax as well. So how in these fiscal notes can I see a better analysis of where the funding, the money is going to be coming from? Is it mostly from the individuals? Are we going to get a lot of from trusts that are already here? How can I break this down to find out, you know, which group are we hitting the most, or is it pretty spread across?
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, let's be clear. All of this revenue will be coming from individuals. The various entities, whether partnership, S-corporation, trust, by the nature of the way they earn money, they pass it through to their owners, who are individuals. Only the actual individuals will be filing this income tax. As far as the source of that income, whether it comes from wages or business property or S-corporations, we don't know that. Offhand, what we own is a complete set of IRS data for how many Alaskans there were in the various income levels, how many Alaskan joint filers there were in the 100 to 150,000 income level, let's just say. The IRS doesn't tell us of that $100,000 to $150,000 income how much of it is wage versus Schedule C business income versus K-1 partnership distributions and the like. I imagine once we have our own data, we will be able to publish that, but it's very hard to know the specific origins. What's important to recognize is it's only individuals. It's the people and their various multiple income sources that will be subject to this tax.
And just to make a clarification, there will be another category of non-grantor trusts, resident trusts, that will file if they retain a distribution. So that's the only category of trust. Grantor trusts flow right through to the individuals, but non-grantor resident trusts may be filing a return as well. So I just wanted to clarify that that there was another category, though small comparatively, of filers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if anything, that helps prove the lack of any direct involvement in the technical writing of this bill that I might personally have.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
I'm just trying to figure out how the numbers were arrived. That's what we're supposed to do on finance. And so just, you know, you had percentages there. We asked for an analysis to be done last time you were here on the drops of the over $2 million of income that has left the state because there's not the same projects up north that there was when I think a lot of these numbers were done. These numbers look pretty close to the same ones that we've seen. They don't look like they've been changed. So was there any analysis done to look at the loss of jobs in the private sector in the last couple years?
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, this was modeled in a pretty straight up way based on a complete set of calendar year 2014 IRS data. The 2015 data has recently become available. We are updating the model for that, but it's not an overnight kind of project. The overall state economy grew slightly between 2014 and 2015, so I don't think you'll see the sort of drop-off you might be anticipating. Yes, certain oil industry jobs were lost. You might see more of an impact when the 2016 data becomes available. Obviously, 2016 taxes aren't even due yet. They're due April 15th. So what we have, what we're also working on is the breakdown of tax liability by quintile, what the lowest fifth, the next fifth, and that's information we will have for the committee hopefully by the end of today. It's in draft form right now. But yes, this is the same IRS data, and it's not, like I said earlier, we know the number of joint filers in a particular income level. We know the number of heads of households in another income level. So based on that, it's just a relatively straightforward arithmetic process, knowing the tax tables and making certain estimates about sort of averages, adding that up to a total revenue impact. It's every time we try to run them, every time we get a slight adjustment to the data, the numbers come out about the same because that's what the tax table says.
Mr. Chairman, and this will be the last because we're kind of going around the questions. I understand how to do taxes. I know it's a math problem. But you're giving us information that is not accurate. You're basing on 2014. This is 2017. And I agree with you that between 2014 and 15, you might not see a big difference because the difference came more into 16, where oil had been dropped down for a long period of time. So to have a fiscal note that reflects $687 million in 2020, when we may not see any more uptick to the economy, we have one of the highest unemployment rates right now than we've seen in the state in a long time, which is not reflected here. So my point is, if we're going to have fiscal notes and we're going to go over them, then it's upon us as a finance team is to make sure they're accurate for our constituents. So that's why we asked for the updated numbers. And I don't need a response because pretty much they haven't come back with answers to our actual questions. But when we're using old data, that's really not fair for our constituents to think we're going to be raising money that may not be there any longer, because you can look in the Department of Labor books. It will give you a pretty good idea of the job loss that we've had, and I think you could have used those to at least had a better approximation than what you currently see in these fiscal notes. But I'll let somebody ask the questions. Maybe they'll do better. Thank you.
So, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson in some ways answered her own question in the sense that even if we had today's information, we can't know possibly what the economy is going to look like in 2020 when we're actually getting the revenue coming in. We are inherently looking to forecast 3 or 4 years into the future. It's a forecast. It's the best available information that we have. And I think Mr. Spanos had something that he wanted to say.
Yes, through the Chair, Representative Wilson, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director for the Tax Division. And I did go back to our economists and ask the question, and they were listening in when you asked the question last time I was here. And the response I got back was that they did factor in the Department of Labor statistics for the current years. They didn't specifically look at the losses on the North Slope. They looked at all the job losses over the state, and they felt that was a better indicator on what the total number would be than just looking at the North Slope numbers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that is where the high-paying jobs are, so I think that would be much different than part-time jobs in other places. But the numbers are the numbers. Maybe they should have not been so specific if they really aren't specific.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
we've got a question from Representative Thompson.
As long as we're talking about page 1 through 4, through the Chair, my question is, you're using how many people you're going to need by using Montana, which has a one-third higher population, by using their one-third higher, putting it to a scale, they're saying 155 employees they have, which would mean we need 120. You're saying we can get by with 60. Is their tax as complicated as this one seems to look? And how do you justify that we can do the same amount of work with half as many employees as what the state of Montana does? You know, and we're scaling up and learning this. I mean, how far off are we going to be with this 60 employees? Because who's going to be auditing companies to make sure that they withheld? And if they sent in the money, I mean, how many people are we going to be adding there? There's a lot of questions here that I question your numbers here for 60 employees by 2020.
Mr. Alper?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, that's a fair question, and we did sort of round down a little, and the rationale for that, and I'll be completely honest, is we believe Montana is, they were giving us, they have pretty much a whole department built around this. We already have a tax division. Like, embedded in that number is a certain amount of our IT staff and administrative staff and accounting staff that we sort of already have. So we are presuming we could add an increment on top of a pretty robust framework that we already have in the tax division and can do it for less. As far as what the audit load is and how complex these are and how many of these things sort of self-administer and how many flagged transactions are we going to have, we obviously can't know that until we start. It is our best estimation that we could do this with 60 people. Frankly, I would prefer to do it with less. I would prefer to not sit here before the Finance Committee and say, if you pass this bill, I need to hire 60 people. That is a hard argument to make in a fiscal crisis. There's no question about it. You're making the case that due is maybe we need 100. I hope not. If it comes to that, then we'll have to address that in the future. I would make the observation that the current costs embedded in this bill, and that's all the years of staffing, plus the big $14 million one-time capital expenditure up front. If you add all that up and divide it by the anticipated revenue, we're spending about 1.5% of all the money on staffing and startup costs. So that is a pretty good overhead number. If we end up coming a little bit short, well, then we're still doing pretty well. It's 1.5% or so of the revenue anticipated.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a follow-up, tax firms in the state of Alaska, not Turbo or QuickBooks or any of the others, each one of these have specialized computer programs. Have you talked to any of the private companies that do taxes, CPA firms in the state, to see what it's going to cost them to reprogram all of their computer programs so that they can match up to this? Have you got any idea of what the cost is going to be to individual tax preparers and CPA firms?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, this is Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue. We haven't specifically reached out to those companies. We are aware that many of them some of them use proprietary software, many of them use customized off-the-shelf software. All of them would have to be reprogrammed. We realize that there is a cost to that. We also understand that there would be revenue generated from that as they gain new stream of revenue. But that wasn't part of the analysis that we did. In regard to the previous question with the 60 employees, that I also had the exact same concern. I would have to administer this tax and would be very concerned that we have sufficient numbers. And so I did reach out to another state that had a closer population base as ours, which was Vermont, and asked them, does this 60 number sound reasonable given that Montana's number was double that for the per capita? Their response to me was, we think that your number is too high. We wouldn't need that many. They have some credits that make their tax more complicated than ours, and they had about as many employees. So they thought without those complications, we could do it with fewer. However, we do want to ensure that we have sufficient numbers, and part of the efforts, if this bill were to pass from the beginning, would be to hire a base staff and hopefully some outside expertise from states that have that experience to guide us as we get up to full staff.
Follow-up, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And in your process of doing this, I'd like to get some information about how much more money will it cost an individual to have their taxes done by adding a state return that's rather complicated, and after a company buying a large amount of money invested into reprogramming their software, what is it going to cost an individual to have their taxes done? Because a huge amount of these 400,000 people are having their taxes done by a accounting firm, a CPA firm, and how much is this going to add to their tax preparation? If you could find that out, I'd like to know.
Sure. Representative Thompson, through the chair, I can respond very briefly, and then we can do some more research on that. But the off-the-shelf systems are generally, for all the other states, That's not entirely true. For most of the states, the same price, and then they have an electronic filing fee at the end of it, which is usually $10 to $20 additional. Some states have passed laws that require the software companies to not charge a fee for electronic filing, and then they build that into the base of the software. So the software would cost off the shelf $10 to $20 more in the state that requirement's there. For those that go into a business to have their taxes prepared, of course, that would range from anywhere from $100 a page to up. So,
for the transcription purposes, that was Mr. Spanos, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, on in terms of the 60 employees and the requested, $4.8 million and moving to 7.7. We heard earlier that there was vacancies in the department, that the money was utilized to be spent on the contractor. So recognizing that there's vacancies and there's additional money in your department, has that been backed out of the money that's been asked, or is this money above and beyond what is vacant and what is additional in your department that you've been able to use in other capacities?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, Ken Alper here. The vacancy rates are relatively high this year, in part because the hiring freeze, although not an absolute freeze, has tended to slow the process of recruitment and filling vacancies. So we've had a higher vacancy rate than typical this year. So finding $85,000 in the tax division's budget is about $15 million, just to put it in scale. Our division, per the way the budget was put in by the governor, I can't speak to its current status, I haven't been following it that closely, is losing 8 positions in the FY18 budget. So our vacancy rate is going to get a lot lower because we're going to have fewer bodies next year. So, no, these would be new positions. They would have new funding associated with them. We would be hiring new people. Now, would some of these new jobs be taken by people who we already have? Frankly, I hope so, because it would be nice to have people with state experience, with state accounting experience, and not 60 new people without any of that trying to run a brand new system. What that inevitably would mean is they would be vacating other positions, and we'd have to recruit for those. But that is within the normal range of rotation and just replacing people who might retire or move on. So, yeah, these are new people. One other number on this chart I might want to draw to your attention, Mr. Chair, now that I'm looking at it, and I'm on page 4. The last line, imaging operators and office assistants, those people who are actually part-timers, for the most part, probably half-year people, these are the people that are taking the paper tax returns and data entering them and scanning them into the system. This is based on the assumption that we can match the permanent funds level of electronic filing, which is 80-85%, somewhere in that range. But 85% with 400,000 filers, that's 60,000 paper forms. That's a big paper load. We would like that number to be zero. We would love it if we could eventually get to the place where all Alaskans would file their taxes electronically. Then suddenly all those people whose job it is to physically open the mail and scan the documents and do the data entry wouldn't be needed. But we recognize that's an unrealistic goal, and we're going to need a certain number of those folks.
You have a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So if let's say in FY19, if you don't need all 10 of the imaging operators or something happens and there's additional money, will it be returned to the general fund, or will you guys ensure? I mean, I guess the question I have is, as we're kind of looking at this and going forward, is if you don't need by chance all of these individuals, will the money make it back to the general fund, or would it be available to be utilized in other capacities within the department?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, and I can only speak for myself. I don't know that I will be the tax director in fiscal year 19, but I am cheap by temperament. I like to not fully spend my budget, and I like to lapse money back to the general fund at the end of the year. If we don't have all of the people that were budgeted for hired, I'm not going to go looking to buy a bunch of fancy desks or something to spend that money. That's not in my nature.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've got a question from Representative Kara.
Thanks, Chair. Now, the question was raised before, what portion of income would various classes of Alaskans pay, and to the extent folks feel it's reliable, in the March 24th memo we got from the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, It says the 40% of Alaskans who earn the lowest wages would, in combination, pay roughly less than 0.5% of their total income with all the exemptions and deductions, and the top 1% would pay roughly 3% of their income under this bill. And they have it broken down by quadrants. That gentleman, I think, testified the other day.
Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, I was trying to get actual numbers, not percentages. That's what the question was. I just have one clarification question. Mr. Alper, did you say that you have $15 million in your budget right now that's not going to be spent because of the vacancies?
No. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the entire tax division's budget for the fiscal year is about $15 million. A handful of vacancies are going to add up to the hundreds of thousands of dollars, perhaps.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just heard that we had the $83,000 because of a $15 million, and I thought that had to do with vacancies, and I thought we were going to get a nice new $15 million back in the general funds. Just trying to find some more money. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I think that pretty much beats the dog of the initial income tax fiscal note, which is in many ways the most complicated and new one that's before you. The rest of the package I can go through with, although not all of them come from the tax division, I could speak to them. The next one down the line is from the Permanent Fund Corporation. That's a ZeroFS fiscal note. And if you look at the narrative, they're basically saying this bill is not likely to change their investment policy, the nature of what they do, and therefore won't change their fee structure. A lot of what they pay for is percentages, what they call basis points, to outside management companies, plus their own staff, and neither one of them are anticipated changing. So this is a zero fiscal note from the Permanent Fund Corporation. And if there's any questions there, I'll pause, but I think I don't expect there to be any. The next fiscal note, which in my packet has a red line through the cover page, I don't know if that's universal, and maybe that means I shouldn't be speaking to it, but this is the Permanent Fund Dividend and the Dividend Fund. This indicates what the dividend would be given the way the bill is currently structured. So $833 million would be the fiscal year 2018 dividend. That's based on, I checked before I came over here, in FY18 and 19, there's something of a higher of structure. You've got the draw, you've got the percentage of the earnings reserve in the underlying bill, the permanent fund sections, and then one-third of that would be dedicated to dividends. Alternatively, should the calculation come below that, there's a minimum dividend set of $1,250. The number here, 833, is actually more to the one-third number. It represents an average dividend, I was told, of a little bit closer to $1,300 would be the expected dividend in fiscal year 18, and then that number would creep up. And this has to do with the underlying size of the permanent fund as expected to be, how the POMV works, the percent of market value, what the expected investment returns are, and all that sort of thing. This is the amount of money that would be spent on dividends given the median estimates for the going forward through fiscal year 2023.
And Mr. Alper, you're on OMB component number 2616, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, the permanent fund dividend.
Got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So could you explain to me why in 2019 we're at 881, and then 2020 we drop down, and then we go back up in 2021, and then it continues to go up. But why do you not see like an increase going from every year? I'm talking under operating expenditures, miscellaneous, and then total operating.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, and this is, it is general fund. It's a direct appropriation from the earnings reserve to the dividend, to the dividend fund. Although, I don't believe it's supposed to actually go through the general fund the way the bill is constructed, so that the fund reference might not be fully correct. But why the number drops down from FY19 to FY20, I don't personally know. I know Commissioner Hofbeck is here. He might have the answer to that. There might be someone else in the room who can. I do see that there's a small drop-off. I don't know what the assumptions are that lead to that. And Ms. Pocan is here, too. Maybe one of them knows the answer to the question.
Would you like to know?
Well, yeah, I took it because it goes from $881 million down to $874. Then back up to 894, then you have an increase from 2022 and 2023.
We've got a question or comment on that from Representative Seaton, and then we may have Commissioner Hoffbeck come up.
And I think if you look on page 2 of 2 in that chart, you'll see that for the first 3 years there, it's 5.25% draw, and then it drops down to 5% draw. So the actual POMV or percent of market value draw drops down to 5% instead of the initial 5.25% before we have a full year of income tax coming in.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson.
So then, after you make that drop, then why would you then see another 20? I guess you're looking for a big increase in the permanent fund to get the $20 million difference between 2020 and 2021. It's almost the same 2019 to 20 million in the next years, and that's showing. I'm just trying to figure out where the numbers came from.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the expected average earnings of the permanent fund are 6.95% per year. So if 5% was coming out to fund the POMV, the split between the general fund and the dividend, that means there's inherent growth to the fund itself in the average year. So you get to the next year, and the base on which you're dividing that 5% is going to be a little bit larger. So that's why you see the growing number. It reflects the underlying real growth of the fund. The idea of a percentage of market value is that it should allow for the self-inflation proofing of the fund. Plus, the permanent fund also continues to get additional deposits from royalties for new oil production getting added to it. So the corpus and the basis of the fund itself keeps getting larger every year. Therefore, the POMV will get larger every year.
And that was Mr. Elper for the record.
And
Representative
Chairman,
Wilson?
I mean, it's great. It looks like the stock market is going to be nice and strong for 4 or 5 years with no dips in it whatsoever, and I would have just thought if we would have taken an average of the 5 years, we might have seen a little bit difference, but thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that is the and there I see why there's an updated version of 2616 that was handed to me, and the difference is that there's the appropriation there's an additional appropriation beyond what was in the governor's budget. Sort of that 883 gets split between what was already in the budget and some increment that gets added because the legislation before you has a larger number than what was originally proposed in the governor's budget as far as the dividend goes. And so what I see, the latest version of 2616 in FY18 has $652 million in the included in governor's FY18 request column and $181 million in what we'll call the appropriation request. That's the extra money. That's what gets the from the original $1,000 dividend that was anticipated in the governor's budget to the $1,250 dividend or the one-third dividend that's in HB 115 committee substitute. So the next fiscal note in the package is the one that says ERA appropriations, component number 3121. And what we're talking about here now is the POMV itself, the 5.25%, again, ramping back to 5%. So the fiscal year 2018 number, based on 5.25%, is $2.526 billion, a little bit over $2.5 billion. You could see that under change in revenues, UGF. That number reflects the full draw from the earnings reserve. That number would then be split two-thirds, one-third, with one-third going towards the dividend fund. And it's mentioned in the narrative there, the little paragraph on the bottom of page one, presuming that number coming out, the amount remaining for the general fund is about $1.8 billion. That two-thirds of the money is going to the general fund, one-third to the dividend. You could see on this table a similar dip in fiscal year 20 to follow up Representative Wilson's question from a few minutes ago. When the number goes from 5.25% to 5%, you're going to see a small decrease between 2669,000 to 2650,000 between FY19 and FY20. So this is the earnings reserve appropriation from the permanent fund. That's this component.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the explanation as well, Mr. Alper. If we were doing the 50-50 plan instead and we're just using realized coming out for the year, how would this compare, this number?
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, let's look at FY19 because FY18 is a little bit unusual because there's multiple transactions in it, right? So you go back to the prior fiscal note and you could see the dividend is supposed to be 881 out of that 2669. So if you were to do a 50-50, 50% of that 2669 or a little bit more than $1.3 billion would be going to the dividend
fund. That's not my question, so can I rephrase my question?
Representative Wilson?
I'm just talking about the complete draw out of the earnings reserve. I don't care if you got – I'm not asking for the dividend and the part of the government, but just a total draw. What would the draw in 2019 be if we – approximately if we were only taking out realized earnings and not dipping back into anything that had been saved? Because it basically calls for that year's earnings. So I'm not asking for you to divide what would be dividend, what would be, but just the draw itself. And then, of course, we would split it in half to realize that half is government and half is not.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's two different 50-50 bills floating around, so I apologize for any confusion. The one that was POMV-driven that has a 50-50 would be the exact same number, simply with a different split. That's where my answer was going before. The one that is tied to the historic look-back of statutory net earnings and using 50% of that, I don't have that off the top of my head. I don't know what that number would be. I believe it's a little bit smaller, but I don't know how much smaller off the top of my head.
And Mr. Chairman, if we could just get it, just because there's just so many things out there, and I'm not talking about how much would be dividend, how much was government, but just the draw itself for like 19 and 20, just to have an understanding on how much of this may be having to be taken out in past earnings that we have in the earnings reserve versus the true earnings for this particular year. So I can wait for the answer. Thank you.
We can get that to you. Mr. Chairman, I know that the commissioner has made presentations on lots of different alternative permanent fund structures, permanent fund bills, presentations. I know we have that work. I just don't have it in front of me at the table. We'll get it to you quite quickly. So that's the permanent fund draw. The next fiscal note in the package is called it's component number zero, interestingly, but it comes and it says various for fiscal notes only. And this one, it talks about a transfer from other funds to general funds, and the FY18 number is $54.9 million. Just pause for a minute and see that everyone has the same document in front of them, and then the FY19 number is $62.2 million. What we have here is that there's a provision of House Bill 115 that changes the deposit of certain mineral royalties to the corpus of the permanent fund. This is the part that says, although the Constitution says it's 25%, certain of the newer leases signed after, I believe, 1980, 50% of the royalties from those leases go straight to the corpus. That is being changed in statute in this bill. So we are essentially repurposing a certain amount of oil revenue and putting it into the general fund and taking it from the corpus, that amount above 25% going to the constitutional number. What that means in real terms is in next year, $55 million of additional general fund revenue. And that number would grow to about $75 million general fund by fiscal year 2023. The next fiscal note in the package comes from the Department of Administration. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on their internal workings, although I will say that the money in this note is a duplicated fund to money that's in the Tax Division's fiscal note, the first one on the package. What we're talking about here is with the expectation that we have 400,000 new taxpayers, some of them are going to end up appealing, some of them are going to end up in the administrative hearing process, and eventually some of them will end up in court. The Office of Administrative Hearings is the quasi-judicial entity within the Department of Administration that handles tax appeals once they get past the Tax Division's initial appeals group. They are figuring it's going to take another person and another bit of infrastructure to be able to handle an increased number of appeal cases, an increased workload. To be clear, the cost of this is covered in the Tax Division's fiscal note. We have an increment on our services line item anticipating that because we, the Tax Division, actually pay this. They send us a bill like many other state agencies do when they provide services, interagency billing. We will be paying this out of the money that's in our fiscal note. So this is a duplicated fund.
Representative Wilson?
So on page 2 of 2, and we get back into trusts and estates and certain exemptions on that. And it talks about, again, that people will be paying on their income in the state of Alaska. So I'm assuming, after I did my homework on trusts, that the way the bill is currently written, whether I lived in the state or not, just so people know, a trust is like, it's almost like a person. Because I know it sounds really weird, but all your stuff, if you do a trust, all your property and everything else goes into this entity. So I may no longer pay taxes myself as Representative Wilson, but my trust will be holding that instead. But it talks about here, any earnings derived in the state of Alaska. If I have a trust, no matter where I personally physically live, if that trust makes money, it is being made in the state of Alaska. And through my homework, I have found that those will be taxed underneath this income tax. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, with the caveat that we are not able to answer all of the trust questions in great detail, it is my understanding that if the earnings derive from an Alaska source, then they will be taxed by this bill, whether those earnings are owned by a trust or an individual or a business. Mr. Spanos might have something to add to that.
Yes, Brandon Spanos through the chair, Representative Wilson. As I read the bill, I agree.
And a follow-up.
And before we do follow-up, grantor trusts pass through everything to the individual. So grantor trusts, which are most of those trusts that are involving a person as a beneficiary, are taxed as the individual, because everything flows through to the individual. So the only thing we're talking about is non-grantor trusts, first of all. And go ahead, Representative Wilson.
Well, I'd like to know what those numbers are, because a lot of them are irrevocable trusts. So basically, I want to have all my stuff in a trust, and hopefully when I die, my children won't be through a lot of pain because of that. They can just take the money. And then that money they would take out of the trust absolutely would be taxed. When we're talking about making the state of Alaska, any money that's made in a trust, because a trust is sitting here, would be taxed. I have a question on the 400,000 new payers. So, first of all, just trying to understand, 400,000 new payers, you're talking about 400,000 individuals who live in Alaska that make some kind of income, or is that a combination of in-state and out-of-state? Where's this 400,000 coming from?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is a rough estimate of the number of households in the state, meaning plus the number of out-of-state filers to the tax. Mr. Spanos, looked like you might want to add something to that. The expectation is, you know, I'm a family of five. I'm only going to file the income tax once. So it's not like this 300,000 other Alaskans that wouldn't be filing. It's just some people are one and some people are families, and then there's the non-residents who also are going to have to file the Alaskan income tax.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Can I get a breakdown of that 400,000? How many of that 400,000 are Alaskan households, and how many of those are out-of-state households, do we know?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this is Brandon Spanos for the record. And in checking, again, with Vermont, who has a similar population base, maybe not as many workers coming in and out, but if we were to make that assumption, 13% of their filers are non-resident, a little over 13%.
And I have some actual data that's the inputs to the model that we've been using to estimate the revenue. The number of Alaskans that are filing federal taxes that we use for this set, there were 128,000 joint filers. There were 184,000 single filers. There were 37,000 head of household filers, and 9,000 what they're calling other filers. And I can't speak to what these might be, but they're likely some of them are those trusts that Representative Seaton referred to, adding up to 358,000 income tax filers in the state of Alaska. There might be some other Alaskans who don't file because they're under the income thresholds. And then there's the non-residents on top of that. So when I say 400,000, it is very much a rough number, but order of magnitude, it's a reasonable estimate of how many we expect to see if an income tax were implemented.
For the record, that was Mr. Alper, Representative Wilson.
So the 42,000 that are out-of-state workers, approximately, do we know that 42,000, how many are seasonal workers and how many are full-time employed in the state of Alaska?
Mr. Alper.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Ken Alper, the
the Department of Labor would be able to provide that information. They know the number of seasonal employees, the breakdown between people who say own property in Alaska that might earn income versus have their own wages or business income in Alaska. I imagine that could be broken out. I don't have that in front of me.
But one more follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Pretty much the same with the 358,000. We don't know how many of those are even seasonal because there are a lot of people in the state that work seasonal as well. So we can't say that we have 400,000 new payers on full-time income levels. They'll be all the way from somebody who works maybe 10 hours a week to those who only work during the summer to those who have basically 40-hour week, 365 days a year.
Through the chair, to be clear, Ken Alper, these are the people who identify themselves on their federal tax paying as Alaska residents. They're people with Alaskan addresses, Alaska zip codes. So whether they are college students who might be filing their own income tax for their summer fishing job or full-time residents or people who do all of their work out of state for that matter, but they happen to live in Alaska, they would fall under this umbrella. Obviously, there's going to be a little bit moving in both directions, and that's why until we actually have a complete data set of filers, we won't know who they are.
And then, Mr. Chairman, trust estates and S-Corps would all be over that 400,000 since they're filing. Some of those aren't even filing right now because they're not being taxed.
Through the chair, the earnings from those S-Corps and partnerships would flow to the individuals who own them, and then those individuals, whether resident or non-resident, would be our filers. Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Gehr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure I understand it because now I'm not sure I do. Obviously, we'd like to tax as many out-of-state people as possible, and that there's only a certain extent we're allowed to do that. With this out-of-state trust issue, so there's sort of an industry here where people make money off people who invest their trust with local banks and local attorneys work on it, and we have no idea how many people benefit from that. We don't know how many attorneys it is, how many banks, but we have that business here. If you're somebody who lives in Florida and you have your trust managed by a local bank, but their investments are sort of like stock market or bond investments, is the person from Florida going to pay any tax on the trust that is managed up here?
Through the chair, Representative Gehr, this is Brandon Spanos. The way that the bill is drafted, it carves out an exemption. It's basically, I believe that the intent of the drafter, the original drafter, and I know what the sponsor's intent was, but I believe the intent of the original drafter was to capture to the constitutional limits the income from trusts from any source within Alaska, which would include the corpus of the trust. So what would not be taxed would be anything that's simply managed from Alaska, but that has no if the securities are simply trading in New York, my understanding is that would not be taxed. If there was some sort of corpus in Alaska that was being managed from an Alaskan bank, then I believe it would be taxed under the current language in the bill.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
we've got a question from Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Maybe I'm way out of line here. I just was thinking too much. You know, the permanent fund education savings that you put in for your kids, how does that fit into this program? Does it? You know, you've got a son when he turns 19, he's going to college, but you've been putting half of your PFD into a savings account for him. Is that somehow involved in this in the future?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, Ken Alper here. To my knowledge, it would not be. That's still your dividend. That's still your income if an individual chooses to do that. The amount going to dividends is still the same. It's just a matter of an optional savings plan, no different than, say, Pick, Click, Give, which is an optional charitable donations plan. There might be other tax implications of education savings might have federal deductibility or the charitable deduction might, but the amount of the dividend remains the amount of the dividend.
And this is Brandon Spanos. I believe it may also depend on whether it's in the form of a trust or not. So if it's in the form of a trust and it's a grantor trust, a non-grantor trust, it may be taxed at the at that level. If it's a if it's simply a savings account, it would be potentially exempt.
Follow-up, Representative Thompson.
Thank you. So when we do our PFD application, we put half into the university savings. What is it? Tell me, where are we at there? I mean, is that...
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I do not know.
But if the question is, when you're putting half your dividend to the college savings, if the dividend is smaller, the amount that goes to that savings account is going to be smaller. I think the way that the program is structured, you click the box and half of the dividend, whatever it is, goes to the account. Right, so obviously it's a function of whatever the dividend is.
That was
Ken Alper.
Sorry, Ken Alper, almost called you representative. Representative Wilson and then Guerra.
So the interest you make off of your savings account will be taxed. The distribution, same thing if you put it in a irrevocable or a revocable trust. Once you put it in there, you can make money, but as soon as that child is now ready to go to school and you give that money to him, it will be taxed because now he or she has removed it, where now you could have those in a trust, make good money, have extra money to send your child to school, but now the state will take a share of that in an income tax. But it's not until you actually remove it from the trust.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'll just speak briefly to that. So it will, of course, depend if it's taxable on the federal level. So if it's taxable at the federal level, when you remove it, it would be taxable in Alaska. And if, of course, the distribution is made from a non-grantor trust, the trust then gets a deduction as well. So those are just some.
Yeah. Representative Guerra?
I think I understand, but the dividend is not taxed under this bill. So if you put the dividend into a trust, at least the dividend itself would not be taxed. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, Spanos, that's correct. Just the interest or income that the trust would earn.
I wonder, and this I'm speculating here and maybe getting beyond Ken Alper here. The language of the bill says the amount of your dividend is not taxable. If you also make a donation that would adjust your adjusted gross income itself to the education trust, it's possible you get a double benefit on that, although I might be sure. Yeah. If it's on the other side of the page, then not so. Never mind.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you. The next fiscal note in the package.
I got a question from Representative.
I don't have a question, but one thing I think is probably good, since we're talking about 529s, I think that's the question. At some point, maybe we need to have someone, because it sounded like that there's about 13. He's not here. There's 11 people around here that are kind of guessing on this. If there may be an opportunity that someone that might be able to answer on 529s, because I think that's what he was asking about. He wasn't asking about putting your dividend into the 529. He was talking about the other side of it. And I don't know that I got an answer out of that whole conversation. So maybe someone at some point in time can answer that question. We were crossing 529s with trusts, and they are separate animals. So I just leave that out there.
Let's... I see staff making a note of that, and we'll round back to that. With that, please proceed.
The next fiscal note in the package is OMB Component 2694, the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. This is the Violent Crimes Compensation Board receives an appropriation from the dividend fund. This is based in part. There are certain individuals who are generally in prison or in some way restricted from receiving a dividend. Their money that would be going to their dividend goes to certain other places. I believe the case being made by the Violent Crimes Compensation Board here is they're going to be revenue neutral and all in this because their budget is what it is, and it's just a matter of backfilling. I don't fully comprehend this note. It's not my agency, but it's a zero fiscal note, and it's making note of the fact that it gets what it requests. It gets its share of the total. And whatever it doesn't get, it gets general funds. So that's my understanding of this violent crimes one. And there might be someone who knows a lot more about me than I do about what that organization does who might be able to follow up. The next one.
Mr. Alper, while we're on this here, we do have a Mr. Kennedy who can address that fiscal note from the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. That's for OMB 2694. And with that, let's see here. He's for 2771. So we have a Kate Hudson from the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. And I believe she's on
Yes, I'm on the line.
Okay, Kate. Yeah, Kate, if you could just walk us through that fiscal note.
Yes, for the record, my name is Kate Hudson. I'm the Executive Director of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. We do receive an appropriation every year from the PFD Criminal Fund. The fiscal note is a zero note because, as Ken Alpha said, our budget is our budget, and we receive an appropriation from OMB every year who make that calculation in order to meet the budget request or the budget request that has been approved by the legislature, and the remaining portion goes to the Department of Corrections. And my understanding from OMB is that will continue to be the case, and any gap that would accrue in terms of permanent fund dividend being lower than in previous years would be dealt with through corrections through an appropriation from general fund to make up any difference. We do not receive any general fund. Our state funding comes entirely from the criminal fund.
Okay, we've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Ms. Hudson, I'm going to have a question on this and the next one because it confuses me a little bit. But so last year's dividend was $1,020. If this bill passes, the dividend will go to up to $1,250. It will still be a zero fiscal note with a bigger dividend than last year, as well as if the dividend were smaller. It doesn't matter. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes, that is what I'm saying. Our budget request has been flat for several years, and in fact, I think in the we'll maybe even taking a hit this year.
All right, thanks.
Any further questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, anything further, Ms. Hudson?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and moving, Mr. Alper?
Mr. Chairman, the next one is from the Department of Corrections, and this is similar in concept, meaning that the permanent fund dividends of incarcerated individuals who aren't able to get their dividend goes to a fund that supports various state services. This is the component that talks about prisoner health care, and they're identifying some millions of dollars that they would be needing to backfill because the smaller dividend would be providing less to that fund. I understand conceptually what they're saying, but I would, Ms. Wilkerson's on the phone, I would rather you get the rest of the information from the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Mr. Alper, and for folks here, that's OMB component number 2952, and we do have Ms. April Wilkerson here in the room. She's the Director of Administrative Services from the Department of Corrections, and she's coming up to the table. If you could just state your name and proceed.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, and I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. PFD criminal funds, they are a portion of the funds that support the physical health care component within Department of Corrections. We receive the funds are calculated based on the number of ineligible applicants that would have received a PFD had they not been incarcerated due to a felony conviction for the eligible year, or if they had been incarcerated of a misdemeanant conviction with a prior felony conviction or prior misdemeanants. The Department of Corrections, based on the calculations and methodology from the governor's office, we anticipate fund changes that will be necessary. In FY18, we are reducing the PFD criminal funds allocated to the department by $9.1 million. We're asking for Alaska Capital Funds to replace that loss in that funding to maintain the health care's budget. We anticipate continued fund changes throughout the year based on the fluctuating PFD with the changes in this legislation.
Got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I still don't, so this for the same reason, well, I don't understand this fiscal note, if you can explain it to me. Last year's dividend was $1,022. If this bill passes, the dividend will be larger. So why would you need more of an appropriation?
So through the chair to Representative Guerra, what we're doing in fiscal year 18, the amount that's allocated to the department is a year behind. So in FY18's fund change, it's based on the 1,022, which reduces the PFD amount available by $9.1 million. That's average, that's continued out and would increase back the PFD allocation in FY19 by the difference between the 9.1 million and the 6.2. So in the FY19, we do anticipate a growth in the PFD criminal funds by 2.8 million. And because of the 1,250 PFD amount that's identified in Section 12, that same amount would carry forward in FY20. And then in FY21, with the changes based on the projections, we anticipate another slight increase of $1.3 million, further reducing the Alaska Capital Fund and offsetting the $9 million reduction taken in FY18. So it's kind of an accumulative throughout the year. And then in FY22, we anticipate almost $400,000 increase to the PFT allocation, and then $410,000 for the final year of an increase.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson and then Pruitt.
I'm sorry, but I didn't get that at all. So I don't, first of all, understand, have you always gone from a PFD criminal 1171 to the Alaska Cap Fund 1197 in previous years?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we have not. This is the first year we are using the Alaska Capital Fund. Previous years, we've went to general funds.
So follow-up?
Follow-up.
So I don't understand. So does this make a difference on what's counted as UGF and what's not? I mean, what is the purpose from moving it from one fund to the other when it's all still supposed to be utilized for the same purpose?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, I don't have the answer to that question, but I can get that to the committee.
That's my concern, Mr. Chairman, as we were going line by line to the budget, is that if it stays in 1171, it stays in the front part counted toward a UGF spend. If it changes to 1197 Alaska Cap, it changes a place in the budget that now it looks like designated general funds instead of undesignated general funds. And I just don't understand, if it's all still going to be utilized for the same reason, why we would be having this kind of switch when it's my understanding it's still going to be used for health care. Is that not true?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, that is true. It's all health care. It was a fund change that was just identified this year. I'll need some additional information to get that to you on why.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm really concerned because it kind of looks like a shell game that we're going from what would have been counted as undesignated general funds. Now it looks like a reduction of undesignated general funds because this one turns into designated general funds or other, and it's still money that we're spending. I just want to make sure that it still counts as a spend.
We've got Representative Pruitt and then Thompson.
Yeah, I've got a couple questions. First one is I can't remember. Do we file for permanent fund dividends for those felons, even if they wouldn't otherwise, so that we can get their PFD? How does that work?
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, we will and we do encourage, but we do more of a tape transition between the department, public safety, and the division of permanent fund, so we can identify the number of individuals that are incarcerated that would have been eligible had they not had that met that criteria in that statute.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I think I understand that. One follow-up here, and that's back to the fund source switch. Is
I believe there's about $91 million or so in the capital fund right now. Do you know how much would have been placed in there this year?
Through the chair, I do not. I'm not the person. I would have to have someone else speak to that.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Normally, the OSCA capital fund has been used for capital projects. So this is a $9 to $6 million reduction in capital projects. Everything from building maintenance to school maintenance, all the stuff that we put in that in the capital project, in the capital budget, which has already been reduced. Why was their decision? This is kind of, I think it almost seems like we're just trying to avoid the utilization of UGF, hence growing the budget, but in, subsequently we're going to be reducing an already very reduced capital budget by using the money over here. Why was the decision to use this? You said it was identified, but we all know about it. We've been using it for years for these types of things.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I don't believe that I'm the person to speak to that. I would have to get back to the committee on why the choice and the decision was made to use the Alaska Capital Funds this year.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, this is, somebody has come and answer this. I mean, this is, they don't want it to be UGF. I get that. But this is going to have ramifications in other capacities. Co-chair there has to put a capital budget together, and we've just reduced some of the money available for you to be able to put that capital budget together and all of the requirements that you're going to have by reducing the capital fund available. So I'd be interested to know why and how we'll fund some of those challenges in the capital budget.
I've got questions from Representative Thompson and then Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm a little bit curious. I don't know some of this stuff here. I do know you were talking about incarcerated persons' permanent fund checks. A certain amount of it is going to health and rehab services or for health care. And there's a portion of that money goes to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Is there a formula about how much of it goes to each location?
Through the chair to Representative Thompson, the number of individuals that are identified as being ineligible is then calculated based on the amount the PFD would be to get to an overall amount that's available. Right off the top, the $1.4 million is allocated to the Victims Crime Board to keep them flat funded, and then the remaining amount is allocated to the Department of Corrections for physical health care.
Follow up. Like I recently heard that the Violent Crimes Fund is upwards of $20 million at the present time. Do you have any information on that? That they have a fund that is built up?
To the chair, through the chair to Representative Thompson, I don't know, have any information on that
one.
She's
still online.
Kate Hudson, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Did you hear the question?
I did, but I have to confess I'm a little confused because there's the Crime Victim Compensation Fund in the state of Alaska, which certainly does not have $20 million in it. I'm not sure if Representative Thompson is thinking of the Federal Victims Fund, but I'm not sure where that $20 million figure is coming from.
Yeah, I didn't have any, through the chair, I didn't have any real facts on that. I had heard some conversation about that, and I wasn't sure if it was true or not, so apparently it might not be true. So, thank you.
Here we've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to get some clarification. The $9,103.6 was in the governor's budget from this fund source, and this is some of those complications of why we have told everybody to look at general funds instead of UGF and make those comparisons so that we don't get these crossovers. We've had crossovers of designated general funds last year, and it was anticipated again this year using part of the higher education fund to pay PERS and TERS, and all of those things go away if you compare general funds and follow general funds, because that includes both sources of funds. And so that's there. I did also want to let everybody know that this is going to be a conferenceable item because the Senate has it in as UGF. So this will be conferenceable at the time.
And Representative Wilson?
So clarification on that, and I don't care if it's conferenceable, it'll be interesting to hear, but it's my understanding that the PFD criminal comes underneath general funds. The Alaska Capital Fund comes under other, which is not counted in UGF or DGF, which makes it look like we've had a decrease in our general funds, when in reality we just had a fund switch. So, but we can wait for the information to get back to make sure that we have it correct.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I appreciate that from the co-chair, because we are aligned on that. I sat in that chair last year and I had a problem with the fact that we were switching stuff and focusing on UGF. So I really do appreciate that. I wanted to note, though, that I wanted to make is, if I recall, some of this money that's the 91 is that's a figure that may be a month or two old, so I don't know the exact. But that $91 million, if I recall, some of that is swept money, just so that people remember, from a couple years ago, there were a lot of the reappropriation money that came up. There was a decision from the co-chair on the other side to sweep much of that reappropriation money, and she put a lot of that in here. And so, again, that actually feeds to another concern I have, and that really is the sustainability of drawing this type of money, even if we were to decide to not utilize it for capital projects anymore, without having the understanding of how much is being added every year into it. It's hard to that creates that challenge of understanding if this is an appropriate decision to make to move this money over there.
We've got Mr. Ken Alper.
Through the chair, Ken Alper, Department of Revenue. A couple of things to Representative Pruitt's point. There is an unusual circumstance in the capital income fund because of the sweep. Typically, this is a zero-sum fund. Money goes in every year. Money gets appropriated to capital projects. There is a nexus to the other parts of this bill because one of the largest sources of revenue to that fund is the so-called Amerada Hess money, the earnings off a portion of the permanent fund that are kept out of the dividend calculation because of a stipulation of a lawsuit over royalties from back in the 1990s. So that number, I happen to know, is around $23 million a year, is the amount of Amerada Hess money that rolls into the capital income fund every year. The rest of it is earnings from other state funds like the student loan fund and that sort of thing, which I think are smaller totals. So in my head, it's around $40 million a year of new money going into the capital income fund typically, plus the unusual circumstance of the swept reappropriate money.
We're good. Thank you. Anything further on OMB 2952? Seeing none, thank you. Next up, we're going to have Commissioner Alper here. I'm sorry, Commissioner Hoffbeck. We'll get this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ken, you guys, I stepped up for a moment. Did you address 2771? That was a duplicate.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure all the component numbers. Which one is 2771? Oh, that was the administrative hearings. Yes, that was the tax appeals. We did talk about that.
Okay, real good. Okay, Commissioner Hoffbeck, please proceed.
Co-Chair Foster, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue, and I didn't come with the presentation. I was asked to be available for questions.
Any questions for the commissioner? Seeing no questions, do you have anything, Representative Seaton?
I guess I'd just like to ask what the administration's general position is on the bill and any problematic sections that you would like to point to us.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, our position on the bill is that We still believe that a draw limit is an important component to have within the bill, and we still feel like the 5.25% draw is sustainable over time, that we would not necessarily have to turn it down to 5%. And then the third point is that We feel like there's a substantial extra burden by going to a $1,250 dividend from a $1,000 dividend. That is going to have to be achieved through either additional cuts in spending or other revenue sources. And so we were more comfortable with a $1,000 dividend, but that, of course, is a balancing position that needs to be made by the legislature.
I also want to throw out here, after we meet here with Commissioner Hoffbeck, we will also be taking up House Bill 137, which is the State Council on the Arts as a public corporation. So we'll stay a little bit later here. But any further questions for Commissioner Hoffbeck? Seeing no questions, thank you very much. With that said, so here to introduce HB 137 is Representative Drummond's aide, Kristen Krondonk, and from the council, Ben Brown. And so if you could please both come up, put yourselves on the record, and introduce HB 137. Please proceed.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kristen Cronendunk, and I'm staff to Representative Drummond. She apologizes for not being here herself, but she is in another meeting at this time. House Bill 137 is an education committee bill. Representative Drummond spoke with all the members of House Education and had unanimous consent before introducing this legislation. House Bill 137 quasi-privatizes the Alaska State Council on the Arts by restructuring it as a public corporation in order to help them work with self-employed Alaskan artists and businesses during these challenging fiscal times. The new status will allow ASCA to increase its ability to leverage funds from non-governmental contributors to better adapt to our shifting economic future. Just to briefly go over the bill, House Bill 137 adds ASCA employees to exempt employee status. Currently, the ASCA has four full-time employees. Representative Drummond's office reached out to those employees, and they were all aware of the changes and supportive of the legislation. The bill adds artist submissions made in response to an inquiry initiated by the council to the list of records that are exempt from public inspection. This does not, however, include artists awarded a commission, so those would still be available for people to look at. The bill adds the appropriate language needed to create trustees, since the corporation would be governed by a board of trustees, and it replaces language that entitles trustees to being reimbursed for travel expenses at the same rate of other members of other state boards. House Bill 137 also adds literary arts as a field represented within the board and replaces educational objectives with strategic objectives as it relates to the council's ability to enter into contracts. Other changes include exemption from the state procurement code while still providing for formal appropriate procurement protocols. The restructuring will also keep ASCA's operating budget under the Executive Budget Act for openness and transparency. The transition language will allow ASCA's advisory committees and the public process to remain in place as it administers grants, programs, and services. Finally, there is transition language in the bill that would allow council members to remain on the board until their term is over and allow current employees to stay on as staff. The effective date for this legislation is July 1st, 2017. The State Council wants to ensure that it is in a position to expand its important work to serve all Alaskans. Private funders across the nation are increasingly approaching the Council to offer their support, and careful, considered restructuring efforts have the potential to allow the Council to advance the opportunity to grow the development base and reduce its reliance on state funds. So we feel that House Bill 137 will improve will improve the ability for the council to leverage non-state funds, and it represents a real opportunity to align the State Council on the Arts to better perform in the environment which Alaska exists in today.
Ben Brown?
Mr. Chairman, Benjamin Brown. I am the chairman of the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and thank you very much for hearing the bill this afternoon. You know, I could certainly, everything that Ms. Cranadonk said, obviously I agree with. This bill is the product of the better part of a year's work by all the members of the council and our staff and our partners at the Rasmussen Foundation and some of the other foundation partners. It's really a carefully put together piece of legislation. We're very grateful that Representative Drummond was willing to sponsor it as a committee bill and that the chair of the Senate Education Committee was willing to do so on the other side of the Capitol. Because you've had a very long week here, I know, and there may be some people signed up at LIOs around the state who want to testify, I would be happy to defer to giving them the opportunity to do so and not, because all of you know me, I could go on about the arts for a long, long time, and that may not be the most appropriate thing to do after the week you've had. So, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'm also happy to defer to those who've signed up and are waiting to testify if that's the will of the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Let's go ahead and do that. So we're going to open up public testimony. And do we have anybody in the audience here? Seeing none, we do have two people on the phone here. So with that, let's go to, first of all, Alice Bioff at Quirk. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
If you could put your name and affiliation on the record and proceed.
Thank you. Yes, Honorable Committee Chair and committee members, my name is Alice Bioff. I'm a resident of Nome, Alaska, currently employed at COWARAC, and an Alaska State Council and the Arts Council member. Thank you all for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 137. I am testifying today in my capacity as an Alaska Council member. I am a tribal member of the Native Village of Koyuk and grew up there and here in Nome. My family and I have lived in Nome for the last 17 years. For most of that time, I have been employed by COWARAC, the regional Native nonprofit consortium of tribes for the Bering Strait region, as a business planning specialist. Through our work here at COWARAC, I am honored and privileged to work with artist entrepreneurs within our communities. We provide direct technical assistance, offering tools and resources to assist artists continue their work so that they can sustain themselves, their families, and their communities. It is through this work that I have seen firsthand how important it is for the artists who live in communities with very few resources and infrastructure to grow their businesses through opportunities such as those that become available through ASCA and others. Artist entrepreneurs are economic drivers, development drivers in their communities, and the Alaska State Council on the Arts support these communities through their work and advocacy. With their partnerships, resources, and programs, we see a bright future and growth opportunity to support all artists across the state. Through the restructuring initiative, we see ASCA services continued and strengthened to support the artists through improved ability to react to funding opportunities and better represent, support, and advance the artists by offering the tools and services needed to strengthen an already existing and important economy. This is critical to strengthening and sustaining our rural communities in this fiscally challenging time. House Bill 137 streamlines the process ASCA will use to present opportunities to artists all over Alaska, including those artists we have worked with for years here in the Bering Strait region. From my perspective, this will be a great benefit for all the artists, including those in rural Alaska. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Bioff. Are there any questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, thank you. Next up, we have Andrea Noble-Pellant. Are you there?
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. If you could put your name and affiliation on the record and proceed.
My name is Andrea Noble-Pellant, for the record. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and I have worked for this agency for 11 years and in the arts sector for almost 30 years. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of HB 137. The Alaska State Council on the Arts exists to support and advance Alaska creative industries and our cultural infrastructure.
And as you know, having a thriving arts community creates a ripple effect around the rest of our state and connects our population. We are in our 51st year, and we're ready for organizational change. The timing is opportune as Alaska's creative industries are growing due to targeted public and private investment in our cultural infrastructure during the past 10 years. As a result, we've experienced rapid growth in grants, programs, and public-private partnerships. We work on local, national, and international levels to oversee projects, initiatives, and policies that build capacity for all of us through arts organizations, and we provide professional development, as Councilmember Alice Bioff explained in detail, and we're very appreciative for that explanation about our impact in rural Alaska. It's something that we're very proud of. We've worked diligently to ensure that this happens throughout the state. Chances for student success are boosted through arts education, and HB 137 provides flexibility for the Alaska State Council on the Arts staff, a staff of only 4.5 currently, to manage fast-flow projects in a timely manner and to increase our work across sectors like transportation and health, economic development, and tourism to ensure that we are having that ripple effect that I spoke about in the beginning. Over the past 10 years, our mission has evolved to expand access to art experiences so that I'm not only talking about art as a product, but art as a process and experience and something that is changing how we live, how we think about our future, and how we are connected to each other. Our programs now reach military service members and their families who experience PTSD, incarcerated individuals who are learning how to create artwork to produce and sell after release so they can be independent and not reliant on others. We impact pre-service teachers from rural communities who want to live and teach in their own community. And we impact children and youth who want opportunities to learn through arts and culture so that learning matters to them. Parents who want to raise their families in safe, sustainable communities. These are all part of our members in our state and our communities who experience the impact of the arts, and again, that ripple effect and why our work has such broad reach. We have been very fortunate that partners with mutual goals have approached us with initiatives that are similar to ours. HB 137 allows for us to be responsive in implementing projects that affect our performance and the ability for us to seek and secure future private funding. A few of our partners, in keeping with our mission, I wanted to mention to you that this is really critical for you to understand. We work with partners and all the revenue from any funder goes back to Alaska residents and communities as grants, programs, and resources. So that's why it's really exciting for me to tell you about this list of longstanding partnerships with the Baskinson Foundation, the Alaska Arts and Culture Foundation, the Atwood Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We have new partners, including Margaret A. Cargill Philanthropies, the Seary Foundation, and the Alaska Heritage Institute. Other partners that we work cross-sector statewide with are the Alaska Humanities Forum and the Western States Arts Federation, and Americans for the Arts contribute in-kind support, resources, and funding. And thank you. If you have any questions, please, I'll be ready to answer.
Thank you, Ms. Noble-Pillant. Are there any questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, are there any other further testifiers in the room or online? I don't believe we have anybody else online. So with that, we will go ahead and close public testimony. And do we have any questions for Ms. Crandon-Donk or Mr. Brown from the committee? We've got a question from Representative Wilson and then Representative Kawasaki.
Just a request, Mr. Chairman. I asked Mr. Brown when he was in my office on the matching funds that are required. If there was some kind of document that shows that it has to be state funds, that it can't be any other funds, that could be provided by the committee to the committee, I'd appreciate that. for an explanation right now.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, Ben Brown again. The provision is laid out in federal code, and so that actually is cited in this current version of the bill. It's black letter law. And we did get to speak about this briefly, Representative Wilson, Mr. Chairman. But one state several years ago tried to go it alone and not have a state appropriation matching the NEA appropriation. It was Kansas. And the NEA worked with Kansas for a couple of years and gave them some waivers, but they never got back into compliance, and they lost their entire federal grant. So, Mr. Chairman, one of the things we've discussed is ways to increase our earned income. That qualifies as a state match. And so you may all remember in the last legislature, Senator Stoltz had a bill for blood bank license plates. Representative Christ Tompkins amended it with Senator Stoltz's concurrence to allow for arts license plates. And we have a process going on now that we're going to have a contest to design license plates, and we're going to get Alaskans to buy those and put them on their cars. You know, if we were California, we might raise hundreds of thousands of dollars selling license plates. I just don't see that happening. But that's one example of where we do want to have some program receipt money that could offset the undesignated general fund money to meet our federal matching requirement. So that program receipts will work. Private money will not work. It's been tried before, and it simply will not work under the provisions of the federal code.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
I always like it when people try to figure out where I'm coming from, and they're wrong. the reason I ask the question is my understanding that there is some federal dollars that we are not able to get because of our match fund. And so anything that we can do, possibly if there's extra federal funding out there that we're just not matching to yet, because of the amount we have here, I just want to make sure if we do well in license plate or however we do it, that there might be more federal funds available at some point, not necessarily decreasing what we have now. But thank you.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chairman, just really quickly, I apologize for trying to think ahead of what you were thinking in terms of asking the question, Representative Wilson. The partnership agreement that the National Endowment for the Arts comes up with is for a three-year period, and it's based on our population and some other – it's sort of a – alchemical process where they come up and they think it's the right amount for Alaska's legislature to appropriate. But then there's also some merit-based competitive funds. Folk and traditional arts are some of those. We did as well as we could in our last partnership application. But then there are also some other funds. Poetry Out Loud doesn't require a match, fortunately. And then the money we're going to be getting for our Creative Forces Initiative to help injured servicemen and women, that also, fortunately, doesn't require me to need to come ask you for another $25,000 of undesignated general funds, because that would be problematic. But we've done very well, and I can assure you that the entire council and our staff, Ms. Noble-Pallant and the rest of the staff, will never leave a federal dollar on the table if there's a way we can bring it back to Alaska and use it for good work here.
Are there further questions? Representative Pruitt.
I think Scott had one too, but just real quick, apologize if you may have said this already. Are you able to the match conversation, are you able to utilize potentially some of the private funds that come in to help get more federal funds? Is that, or just it's state funds?
Mr. Chairman, so right now our budget, a little over half of it's coming from private foundation money, and then the two other quarters are basically our state appropriation and our NEA match. Anything we can get with that basic infrastructure and our small but hardworking staff from a private foundation is over and above on top of that what we can use to support our mission. But that base federal match requirement, it is what it is based on the NEA's calculation of our partnership agreement amount.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the question that Representative Wilson has, so are we up to the max federal match currently?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, we are not overmatched and we're not undermatched. We're doing just the right amount. Some states actually appropriate more than they need to, and we've not been one of those states. I think the entire time I've been on the council, which is 13 years, certainly the 10 years I've been the chairman, we've just not ever thought that was likely to be a winning argument in this capital. And that's really one of the things that's driven us to work with non-governmental sources to try to find more money to do good work to help people enjoy the arts and culture more. So, no, we're right exactly where we need to be in terms of our federal match, Representative Kawasaki through the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then another question. This won't jeopardize any of the NEA match by going to a public corporation, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, very important question, and no, we have kept in touch. I'm fortunate, actually, to have a pretty good working relationship with Jane Chu, who's the current chairman of the NEA, but she is a political appointee and will not be there in perpetuity. But the senior permanent staff who were there, we consulted with them throughout this process, and no, this will not in any way jeopardize our NEA match.
Okay. Okay. And that's National Endowment for the Arts.
Yes, that acronym usage, which I castigated myself for in Senate Finance, the National Endowment for the Arts, not the National Education Association.
And then just one more question. We've had State Art Council, like, I don't know, for how many years? Decades.
And it's, Mr. Chairman, it's slightly older than I am, so about 50 years.
Yeah. And then, so through the chair, is the public corporation the kind of way that other states have encumbered any National Endowment for the Arts match, or is it typical for states to have a council or a committee or a commission within their?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, you have to have some sort of a council that has public members. But within that larger mandate, every state does it a little bit differently. Some councils have legislators on them. Some are really, really large. 11, the smallest council is 9, so 11 is smaller than the average of 15. We will be the first state to have a quasi-private public corporation, and I would say with some pride, other states are looking kind of with interest in what we're trying to do here, because the way this will free up staff time to be more nimble and responsive and to move people between positions. You know, in other states, Hawaii is an example, they're located in their Division of General Services, and a former Hawaii chair, a friend of mine, said, yeah, we're there with the janitors, basically, with the folks who take care and clean the buildings. And so they are all line classified employees, deeply ensconced in the union ways of Hawaii public employees. And frankly, this former chair, who was a pretty close friend of mine, found it difficult to do some of her work as a chair, and the council was not able to be as nimble and responsive. So this is something that I think could actually set a positive example for the rest of the country if we're able to do it successfully here in Alaska, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, House Finance Committee will meet again tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. on Friday, March 31st. At that meeting, we're going to hear HB 31, HB 49, or HB 31 is a sexual assault examination kit, HB 49 is extended board of direct entry midwives, and HB 141, Alaska Workforce Investment Board and Funds, and we'll be adjourned at 3:50. Thanks, everybody.